Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. You know, life is a really, really interesting thing because it's got so much variation to it. And speaking of variation, we're going to bring on a regular guest now, Suzanne Posel. I know the irony of that. Yes, I realize it. I am an irony man, much like a black sand beach. And also, we've got caller line open. So if anybody would like to call in and comment on the news of the day or anything else you freaking well feel like. Really? Are you down in the dumps? You've had some scumbaggery or something in your life. You hate your boss. You're about to pop an SSRI drug and do a murder suicide or something. Call into the show. We'll set you right. Suzanne Posel, welcome.
Hello, everyone. It's interesting.
I think I just lightly polished on the SSRI drug murder suicide phenomenon. How the hell do I do this thing?
I ask you all the time. I wish I could come up with a quip the way that you do. You're going to have to show me how, because I always think about something cool to say about an hour after the whole incident is over.
You know, see, honestly, I don't know how. I think I was just born really messed up.
Just really sardonic in a very humorous way. Most people go to school to train to be that. You're just naturally that way.
Yeah. Isn't that awful? All right. Speaking of awful times, we have our first caller in the line right away. Probably an SSRI killer in the making. Ernie in California. You got your guns locked and cocked?
Oh, yes, man. You know it, Benny. At least we get to keep ours. I don't know about New Zealand.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll see about that.
Yeah. If Diane Feinstein has her way, nobody's going to have guns.
Well, they already, a gentleman went to a mental health facility for 2 days, and they raided his house 2 days later and took his gun. So it's going to start, but you know what? I think the globalists, the Illuminati, world order, what do you want to call them? I think they're really underestimating Americans. I know they have, you know, 2 billion hollow points. They just ordered 2,700 RVs, I call them, basically RVs, you know, bomb-resistant vehicles with flames that shoot out the side. And I just want to wake up. I live with a sheep who will sit there and stare at that frickin' CNN, that MSNBC, mind control, glued to it, and you cannot wake these people up. So my point is, how do you wake up somebody who went through the liberal college, brainwashed as a liberal? How do you even approach them?
Well, first thing you can do is you can call the cops on them and make up a manufactured story. And then when the cops come in, bust them for absolutely no reason and taser them, then they'll be really suspicious of the cops all of a sudden. Then they'll be open to whatever you're telling them.
You can't do that.
I have taser marks to prove that one.
You got taser marks, yo.
Yeah, I've been tased. I got 2 scars. I've been there for 2 years, and I don't think they're going to come out. But, yeah. But, hey, I want to thank you, Vinny. I think you do an awesome job because you do put a spin of happiness on what is really a bleak thing. I live in Central California, and they chemtrail the heck out of us. But right now, I'm doing some, I got some non-GMO seeds and planted them. I got the roots going up. And I found out there's a soil out here. I don't know the name of it. I don't want to promote anybody. But it takes the hot particles and holds them in the soil and doesn't let them go up into the plant. So I'm going to research and find out if it's true because living in California, I will not let my kid out in the rain. I know what the rain here is, acidity, and put it this way, it's got probably cesium, strontium, and who knows whatever else in it. So I just want to thank you for enlightening me and making me laugh in a world that is so sick.
Well, you know, you're welcome. I experience a lot of the laughter of this show too. You know, I'm not just making these jokes to make other people laugh. I don't really care whether or not other people will laugh, Ernie, to tell you the truth. I'm just here to amuse myself, and if other people want to be amused too, that's freaking awesome.
I've got you, mate. Thank you very much. I'll keep listening to the show, and everybody, just try to wake up the friends. I know, especially the Bible thumpers, they're the hardest. You know, I feel bad for them. I was an Roman Catholic, altar boy, Jehovah's Witness, and boy, that's some really good mind control. Wow. Other than that, wish you the best, my brother, and love to all of you.
Thanks, man. Okay, now we have my second hour guest has actually now arrived, Michael Sherlock, I believe. AFR, if you're there, could you please bring him up into the chat there? Sorry, Suzanne, we haven't had much of a chance to talk. My guest has turned up.
No, that's wonderful.
Well, we're waiting for him, on the other hand. Is there any news you'd like to share?
I wrote an article about how the mainstream media is demonizing patriots, claiming that they're going to set off a second Oklahoma City attack. That's a very big story. Wrote an article about Dianne Feinstein and her comments that all veterans are mentally incompetent and they should not have any provisions in her assault weapons ban bill for 2013. That they retain the right to keep their guns. They should all have them all removed because they could be potentially mentally deranged or have, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, TBI, all those things. I just got done writing an article that will go up tomorrow. The U.S. Navy has come out and said that because of man-made climate change, there's a threat to national security as far as the armed forces go. So we need to find ways to combat. And they actually have a task force that they set up in 2009 just specifically for the U.S. Navy in regard to climate change and how to combat it. It's very interesting. So look for that article, OccupyCorporatism.com, tomorrow morning.
We still have another 2 minutes as well before while my guest is getting ready. There's been a, as I mentioned on the radio the last couple of days, is that the U.S. time zone's just taken on daylight savings, and so that actually has a physical effect when we're talking from the Southern Hemisphere, like a whole hour shifts back. So instead of doing the show midday till 2 p.m., it's actually like 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., so my guest thought he was going to be coming on next hour, and so he thinks he's here early. Sorry, mate, you're actually here late. Yeah. And that's the funny thing.
It should be an interesting interview. I'm having him on, I believe, at the end of the month. He wrote a very interesting book about belief and the power of belief and how it makes people do things that it shifts their personal paradigm to get them to do things that they wouldn't normally do.
What, police?
Well, police do that, yes, but how belief and that whole mind system that goes into believing in something, once you commit to a belief, how it affects you psychologically, and then the choices that you make because of that.
Mm. Well, you know, I think belief's a double-edged sword, kind of like technology. You know what I'm saying? You can either believe that doing the right thing involves killing innocent people, or you can believe that the right thing is saving innocent people from death. And both people sincerely hold their beliefs. And I think what people forget is that if people are willing to act on their beliefs, it does affect you, even if you don't believe or what they do. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that's the kind of society that we're living in now. It's just this contest of beliefs, and people think that that it doesn't really exist or whatever until they get blown up or something.
Right. Think about how the beliefs that we were brought up with affect us, and then once we come to realize that everything we were told was not true or a version of the truth, going back and looking at how we were raised and what ideals our parents instilled in us and what that means once you realize that what is really going on, how that shifts your paradigm. That's very shocking.
Now, at the moment, we're kind of very tight-lipped. You know, there's things going on in the background that are stressing the both of us out. We don't really want to mention it on air. And just in terms of stress and things of that nature, how difficult is it really for you writing articles every day and raising a family on a shoestring budget?
Well, my husband and I shifted what we think is important several years ago, about 7 years ago, when we got on this organic farm in Colorado and lived there for 5 years. And you do without a lot of the modern necessities. And it's very quiet out there at night, and you can actually sleep and hear the animals. These things affect you, living with the cycle of the day and the night and getting up in the sunrise and going to bed at sunset. All of these things affect you, and so we don't have a need for extravagant excess. We care more about the quality of the time that we spend together than the toys that we can purchase. So being on a shoestring budget doesn't bother us because that's the lifestyle that we choose to live. What our ideals hold for us. But I love what I do. Absolutely love what I do. And I love the fact that I've been able to meet so many wonderful people because of it. Not just radio hosts like yourself, but also I have listeners and readers that I give my cell phone number to when we talk, and I get to meet all these great people that I would have normally gotten a chance to meet. So I absolutely love what I do, and my husband is very supportive. And the children, during the day, the day is for the children. I homeschool my son from 9 until noon, and then we go out and we play in the park and we spend time together. And I make that a point. Everything I do for the website happens at night, and because I love what I do, I stay up till all hours of the night. But it's a very rich and rewarding life that I've built for myself, and it's because of the fact that I got into the alternative media, and my whole family structure has shifted, and what we believe in and what we hold dear has shifted. So it's actually a really wonderful thing that all of this has happened.
Well, I think you learn to appreciate different things because you're forced to recognize that most of the things you used to appreciate, most of the things you used to strive for in your life and try to do, don't actually matter.
Yes, absolutely. All the way down to, you know, what type of shoes you wear, whether or not you bought the latest toy. None of that matters. We go to the park, we go to the zoo, we go to museums, we go to art shows, we go to local where people play local bands. We enjoy our time. We'll go out as a family to the park and just wander around for 3 hours and let the kids explore and have a good time. We don't ever go to the mall. We don't ever go to pre-designated areas where they, you know, you stay to have a good time.
Yeah. You know, this reminds me of when I was a flashy salesman and I had a belt buckle that was like half the size of my face, and it was like in a big, you know, American dollar sign. And it was like all encrusted with these cubic zirconias kind of thing, you know. The belt buckle itself cost me like well over $100.
Wow.
You know, and I was just thinking about it, you know, man, how much of a douchebag was I walking around with this freaking thing that could like rival the sun when light reflected off it? It's just insane.
No. You weren't a douchebag. You didn't know any better, and you were trying to do what you thought was right.
Actually, I was trying to do what I thought looked cool.
Well, yes, exactly, because you think that you have to fit in, and if you don't look a certain way, you're not going to. The wonderful positive aspect of waking up is that those things don't matter, and you can actually look at the things that do matter and start to appreciate them, and who cares? If something breaks, you go and replace it. However, you're not tied to keeping up with the Joneses anymore. That frees you. It's such a relief.
Yeah, as it were, the pressure comes off. Now, we have our special guest for this hour turning up now, Michael Sherlock. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me, Vincent. I do apologize for being late. My publicist was, I think, got the times a little confused.
No, I think it's just more like we had this time zone change. You know, daylight savings in the States happens, and then everything gets shifted back by an hour. So I assumed that you'd probably turn up in the second hour at some point, but I didn't know exactly when. Well, anyway, we're about a minute and a half from break. So if you want to just quickly give us a capsule review of just who you are and what you do before we go to that, and then we'll get into the interview right after.
Sure. I'm an author who's published a book called I Am Christ, The Crucifixion, Painful Truth. And that book is the first volume in a three-volume series. And it is an attack on the Christian religion or the Christian belief system and an attack on the significance we place on belief itself. And so in the book, I run through belief from the social psychological perspective. I look at belief from the neuroscientific perspective. I also talk about what I call a psychological phoenix, and that's the burning of one's beliefs, the giving up of one's beliefs in order to become a little bit more enlightened. Then I go into an attack on the Christian Gospels, which are the foundation of the Christian belief system, these four Gospels that were selected by the Proto-Orthodox Church, and I show that they have a lot of contradictions, they're not exactly historical. And so that's basically what the first volume deals with. It also looks at the historical Jesus question and showing that there's not really much historical evidence for a character named Jesus that was described in the Gospels. And so, yeah.
All right. Well, it's remarkably synchronistic because that was exactly what we were talking about how people's beliefs affect you, even if you don't believe it, kind of thing, and how you can wake people up to reality if they don't know what the heck it is, sort of thing. So this will be interesting. We'll be right back.
All right. Please don't desert me.
Ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. Believe what you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about the Bilderberg and New World Order? What you know about the real fluoride in your water? What you know
Welcome
about
back. The greed of uranium and the mortar? What you know about... Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about the fluoride in your water and the depleted uranium in the mortar. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show. From the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chains nation and the sunny slave South Pacific, my very special guest, guests, plural, Michael Sherlock and Suzanne Pozzle is just going to be sitting in. Now, there's a bit of a synchronicity thing happening here, and it happens on occasion. In fact, it happens every single day with me. There'll be some kind of synchronistic, like, oh, that's meant to be. So we were talking about belief structures and all of this kind of stuff, and then Michael comes on and he's talking about all these Christian-based belief structures and things like that. Incidentally, exactly the thing that we were talking about. And incidentally, Suzanne Pozzle is going to be interviewing him, like, what, next week? Is it Suzanne?
It's the last Thursday in this month. He's going to be out for the 2 hours. Yeah.
I'll try not to be late for your one, Susan.
Okay.
Yeah, so there you go, ladies and gentlemen. There's this little trifecta of synchronicity McThingamajigger going on here. Anyway, Michael, would you please be able to explain us what your perspective is on the Christian religion and belief structures and things like that? Because I'll just preface this with my concern about it, is that there's a book of laws, right? It's called the Bible. It's only like this big, you know, it's not that thick. Whereas if you read the Patriot Act, it's about 10 times as thick as the Bible. Which laws do you want to follow, you know? The other side of it is just general rules for life, you know? Don't be a douchebag. Don't kill no motherfucker. You know, just some simple things that make life actually much easier for everybody, especially the people that rule over you who don't have to worry about you attacking them or killing them because your beliefs prohibit you from attacking the people who are killing you.
Yeah. Well, I think there are a number of problems with the emphasis we place on our beliefs, and I think I need to qualify this statement as well, because belief is a natural aspect of the mind. We can't escape it entirely. For example, I believe tomorrow will come. I don't know tomorrow will come. I believe it will come. But if I didn't believe tomorrow would come, I couldn't organize my life. So beliefs can be very practical. They can be very helpful. And also they can give us a sense of order. So they are important as well. But like everything in life, they're dualistic in nature. That is, they have another side to them. And this is the side that social psychologists have been pointing out, that neuroscientists have been pointing out, and that is they are inextricably linked with A, our ego, and B, our emotions. So because they're very emotional in nature, when we adopt a belief, or and what I'll call an unjustified belief in Platonic terms, something that we cannot go very far in proving, something that we believe without evidence, Jesus came back from the dead, Muhammad spoke with Gabriel the angel, Obama is for hope and change. When we have these, we develop these kind of beliefs, we take them and they get rooted in our mind, they anchored down in our mind by emotion. And once we've adopted the belief, our mind employs, employs strategies to keep that belief intact. And it will fight tooth and nail to keep those beliefs intact, regardless of the evidence, regardless of the truth. But I think that truth, in my opinion, truth is much more important than my beliefs. And we need to find a way to ascend beyond belief-based thinking, or unthinking, as I call it. And this is what the Crucifixion, Painful Truths chapter of Volume 1 is all about. It's about ascending beyond emotional interpretations of the truth and getting to a more enlightened state of mind where we will not be manipulated by our beliefs. We will not manipulate ourselves, more importantly, you know, via our beliefs. And so Volume 1 is concerned with highlighting beliefs, what they are, the emotional nature of beliefs. So I go into what I call the three primary emotional elements of belief, and that is the inheritance factor. That is, we inherit, especially with regards to religious beliefs, even political beliefs, they're inherited. They're a socially contracted virus, if you like. We get them off others. Okay, we get them off our parents, close friends, whatever. Okay, so they're socially contractible, they're inherited.
Socially transmitted disease, like an STD?
Exactly right. Yeah, exactly right, for the mind. and they can be quite devastating to the mind, in my opinion, as well. I mean, they can cause people to live a whole life asleep, basically, on autopilot, whereas their whole worldview, the whole way they view the world and their meaning and purpose and everything in life, the possibilities they're capable of, what they're not capable of, are all determined by these beliefs. So essentially the person has become the puppet of the belief. And so in my book, I use as an analogy, I analogize that Judas from the Gospels is our belief, and the Christ in the Gospels, this mythological character Christ in the Gospels, is the higher self, the self that's willing to undertake the crucifixion, in I'm speaking symbolically only, of the mind, the crucifixion of the mind, because that's what it is when we have to overcome our beliefs. We undergo a crucifixion of the mind. It's very painful to look at a long-held belief that you've had and say, all right, well, I think that belief is flawed and I've been wrong. So as I mentioned before, there's the inheritance factor. We inherit these things. So when people attack our beliefs, we take it indirectly, either consciously or subconsciously, as an attack on the person who we receive that belief from. So, well, my father taught me to believe in Christ and he's the only way, and now this person is attacking my belief in Christ. Well, by proxy, they're attacking my father. And what are you calling my father, stupid? He believed it. He taught me. It must be the truth. But the truth isn't determined by your teacher, the person who you contract this belief from. Also, there's the ego factor, which is the second element I'll talk about in the book. The ego factor is a massive factor, and it's something that psychologists and social psychologists have pointed out, that our views about the world.
That's something I found very interesting, is that the fundamentalist
Christian belief in the Word of God gets just as egoically and emotionally engaged in as atheists' disbelief in religion and God. I found that particularly interesting that they will both obsess. They will both obsess and not listen. Based upon their belief structure, whereas one of them believes something and one of them claims to not believe something, and they still go about it the exact same way.
Well, I make this point in the book as well. That's an excellent point you raised, Vincent, that disbelief can be just as misleading as belief itself. And so generally what we believe will impact on what we don't or cannot believe, because it will want to set up a shield. And that shield is often disbelief, and that disbelief can take the form of a disconfirmation bias with regards to information, with regards to other beliefs. But for me, I think if I had to choose, well, do you want to be a believer in God or do you want to be an atheist? I would choose atheism in the sense that there are many atheists who don't say, well, there is no God. There are many atheists who say that we don't know there's a God. There could be a God. It's possible, but we haven't been presented with sufficient evidence to make a conclusion.
And I thought that was called agnostic.
Yeah, agnostic is in that sense, yes, but atheist just generally means, it comes from the Greek term, atheist meaning without God, without a God. It doesn't necessarily mean you disbelieve categorically that a God exists. It means that you just want to follow the evidence. And if the evidence isn't sufficient to make a conclusion, you won't make a conclusion. And that's, I guess, where I lay. Perhaps I lay between atheism and agnosticism somewhere. But I don't like to. I'd never call myself an atheist. I'd never call myself an agnostic. I don't call myself an Australian. The only thing I call myself, I guess, is stupid sometimes when I make a mistake. But
because that at least you can find some evidence on.
That's right. That's right. I can conclude. I have evidence. That I am stupid sometimes. Yeah, that's right.
I do that myself, you know. I just think to myself, man, Vinny is so stupid, and I deny it, and I go, no, I'm not that stupid. And I go, you are stupid. I have the documents.
that's getting into schizophrenia, but that's not too bad. We're all a little bit schizophrenic. And actually, in my book, in the beginning, I raise an example in the foreword of my book. My father was a drug and alcohol counselor in Sydney, and one of his clients was a schizophrenic who was a very successful stockbroker before he had a schizophrenic episode. And that episode cost him his job and then led to a nasty drug habit or cocaine habit. And I remember my father would come home and tell me all about this guy, and he was fascinated with this client of his, this schizophrenic guy. And he used to say that he just had the most amazing opinions and perceptions in the world around him, things he'd never thought before. And so my father used to say that I think there may be some evidence to say that 9 times out of 10, the people in this world we deem crazy are actually the sane ones. And the people we deem sane are insane. And like at first I was like, okay, I think dad's losing it. I think he should stop hanging around this schizophrenic guy. But then he explained it and he said, well, we live in a world that's full of poverty, famine, war, totally unnecessary suffering that goes on in this world as a result of complacency, the chronic dependency of the masses. And we all go about our lives without blinking an eye. Most people will say, well, you know, I'll give the homeless some thought today, but then I'm going to go back to watching TV, The Price is Right is on, or The Wheel of Fortune, whatever is on. So they can live knowing that this is going on right now to their fellow human beings, that children are starving to death, that mothers are watching their children die in wars that are politically and religiously motivated, they can just live their life on this thin veneer of what we call sanity. But the person who we deem insane is the person who says, no, I can't live in this insanity. And they exhibit what we call an insane response. But the insane response is to the insanity that they're countering. So if you look at it, the response is matching the insanity. It's an appropriate response to the world that we're living in. And so, yeah, I guess there's that part of it. I don't want to make people think I'm too crazy, but yeah.
I don't know about you, but as a proud conspiracy theorist,
I have been, you know, and I believe a conspiracy theorist means somebody who believes that there are powerful people who have a lot of influence, who use their power and influence to maintain it, you know, or grow it. Mm. That's my simple definition for it. I've been called very, very many times a crazy person or paranoid or something of that nature. And what's interesting to me is that I know that I'm not crazy and I know that I'm not paranoid. And so anybody who accuses me of such looks really crazy and paranoid to me.
Yeah. Well, everyone's, this is the thing as well. Everyone's coming to the table with their own beliefs. But can we put the mirror on our own beliefs and say, okay, I'm going to pick holes in my own belief. I'm going to take apart my own belief and look at the evidence for and against my belief without my emotions. That's a really hard thing to do, even for me, for the people who have put a great deal of thought into this specific area of investigation. It's really hard to do, almost impossible. But if we can just start to move towards that less emotional interpretations of the truth, of what we deem the truth, what others deem the truth, we can find understanding with those who have opposite beliefs than ourselves. And I think that's the most important thing, and the second most important thing. The most important thing, in my opinion, is we will stop being manipulated by faith peddlers, political or religious faith peddlers. Basically, in my opinion, our beliefs are like the little hooks that leaders can just stick their hooks into, basically, or little catches that our leaders can stick their hooks into and lead us wherever they want us to go. It's just provide the right emotional stimuli, the right scenario, and we will respond because they know our beliefs. They know that they're emotional. They know what upsets us, certain believers, what upsets other believers, and they can just give us the right stimuli to make us move like robots, basically. And so we're very easily manipulated by our emotions. And
well, that's very interesting because I was having a conversation, I think either yesterday or today, about how some radio show hosts appeal to emotions and things of that nature, and they become incredibly popular. Yet you have a look at other talk radio show hosts who take emotion out of the game whatsoever, and just look at the information, and they barely anybody's ever heard of them or follows them. Yeah. You know. Because only those with critical thinking ability actually like those kind of shows. And the rest of the people are just easily drug around by their emotions, especially in a movement like conspiracy theories and things of that nature.
Yeah. I spent some time researching conspiracy theories for a while. Some, I think, have quite a bit of evidence behind them. Some, in my opinion, don't. But again, I'm bringing my own personal biases and beliefs to the table, so I recognize that. Actually, I don't know if you've heard of a guy called David Icke.
I've interviewed him, yep.
Oh, you've interviewed him, yeah. He published one of my articles. It was actually an excerpt from Volume 3, I Am Christ, The Ascension Understanding, which is on the church's use of hypnotic manipulation. And so I go through and I show how the church uses the five steps of hypnotherapy in each church service, whether it's Protestant, Evangelical, Catholic. And so I go through that, yeah.
Wow. Well, I think that's another interesting element that we should cover after the break. Churches using five stages of hypnotherapy. That sounds intensely interesting to me. We'll be right back with my very special guest, Michael Sherlock. Just a few Thank minutes, you. Ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's the final segment that we've got here on air with Michael Sherlock. I think he's the author of the book I Am Christ, and Suzanne Posel just kind of sitting there in the background, you know, snuggling into a beanbag or something. Michael, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Vincent.
All right. Where were we? The five methods of hypnosis or mind control or something in a church service, what were they?
Okay, yeah. So in the third volume of the series, which won't be out till next year sometime, it's a little, it's in the future, it's coming in the future. I go into the five stages of hypnotherapy and I show how those stages exist within the church service. And that is the introduction, the induction, the deepening, the suggestion, and the awakening. Those five stages can be found in a church service, in any church service, and I thoroughly demonstrate that over a whole very big chapter in my book. But I wrote a small excerpt. I took a little bit of that out and made it its own article. So I made an article out of that. And David Icke published it, and Red Ice Radio, can't remember the guy from Red Ice Radio.
Heinrich,
yeah, I really like that. These kind of guys published it, so they found something of value in it. But I wasn't really coming from a conspiratorial point of view when I wrote that. But I think that it certainly can be used in that, because politicians use, you know, hypnosis, trance, induction, these kind of things. They use NLP, which is neuro-linguistic programming, and I have a whole chapter dedicated to neuro-linguistic programming in the Christian church as well, in the third volume of my series, because the third volume, basically my three-volume series, is an analogy, a metaphoric three-step process to enlightenment. But it's not a how-to manifesto of enlightenment. You're not going to learn how to become a free thinker. Someone once said that critical thinking is never inherited. And it's up to you. I can't give you something. I can't give you a magic pill or a couple of magic words that's going to change you into a critical thinker. You have to find that within yourself. And so basically, my three-volume series, The Crucifixion, is volume one, and that's about becoming to your own mental crucifixion, giving up your beliefs, recognizing your beliefs for what they are. They're emotionally driven, emotionally maintained. A belief is a matter of fact. Belief is a matter of choice, not a matter of fact. Yeah, so that's very important, I think. Belief is a matter of choice, not a matter of fact. Too many people overlook that. And so it's about succumbing to your psychological crucifixion. It's very Jungian in a sense. And Joseph Campbell, I don't know if you've heard of Joseph Campbell, the great mythology lecturer from Princeton. He's from another college, so I can't remember. But he was very good, and he followed a lot of Jungian teachings and sought out a lot of symbolism, valuable psychological symbolism that are in our ancient myths. And I do that as well in my book, in the second chapter of The Psychological Phoenix. I use the phoenix as an analogy of this crucifixion of the mind. And coincidentally, Clement of Rome, an early church father, saw the story of the phoenix is very similar to Christ. And that is the death and resurrection motif coming out. And it's about that. It's about the death, giving up the ego, letting the ego die, and having it resurrected. Now, the pernicious side of most religions, in my opinion, is that they will exoterically, on the surface, promote humility. They will promote giving up the ego. And I think those are very good things. But to follow these religions, you must become egocentric. You must submit to the doctrines of this religion. You must see your religion as the only right religion. My beliefs are the right beliefs. My God is the only true God. And this is the textbook definition of egocentrism. So you have to become egocentric in order to follow these religions that are saying you should be humble and you shouldn't be an egocentric. And so that's a great irony of religion. It's a great kind of doublespeak of religion, if you like. And once you're egocentric, you're basically easy to control. Egocentrics are very easy to control. So the first volume is to do with the crucifixion mind. The second volume is the resurrection. I am Christ, the resurrection. That volume deals specifically with the history of the Christian church, the manipulation of history. We've all been led to believe that Christians were persecuted everywhere prior to the 4th century. And it was all the time, there was nothing but Christian persecution, and the persecution is used as a tool to convert new people out of sympathy. And we can see that Islam is doing the same in the West today. Many Muslims have been unjustly persecuted after 9/11, And this sympathy that a lot of people have has turned Islam into a counterculture. Okay, it's turning Islam into a counterculture in Europe, and you'll see that the numbers of Muslim converts are starting to skyrocket, and that is because people see it as a counterculture to an oppressive regime, an oppressive government, which these governments are oppressive. But they're falling into a counterculture that is equally as oppressive. And that is, if you read through the Quran, you read through the Muslim Hadith, you see they're extremely oppressive, they're manipulative. It's the same as Christianity. It's Christianity Mark II, basically. And so the resurrection deals with the manipulated history, going through all that. It looks at the fictional nature of the Christ figure. That is, and I use comparative mythology to show that this character existed 1,000 years at least prior to Jesus Christ of the Gospels. That is, someone who was born of a virgin, who escaped early infanticide by a local tyrant, who was, there's just so many in there, who died and was resurrected, and all these motifs who ascended in front of people. And you can, if you look at all the ancient literature, you'll see that all these motifs for Christ existed in the earlier religion. And this is what led St. Augustine, the early church father, to say that what we call Christianity existed amongst the ancients, which is a very odd statement to make. It's supposed to be a historical religion based on a savior who came 2,000 years ago, was unique, but the fact is, no, it wasn't. It's been around for a very long time. And
yeah,
so,
I heard that as well, that Christianity itself as a religion is as old as the human race itself.
Well, that's somewhat of a yes and no. The motifs that exist within the Gospels that were selected by the proto-Orthodox Church existed. And another qualification is that the proto-Orthodox Church, which later became the Catholic Church, which later became the Protestant Church, and all the 38,000 other denominations now Christianity, that one small handful of men selected 4 Gospels through Irenaeus. They selected his choice of Gospels. He lived in about 180 BCE. He's the one who first said, we need 4 Gospels, no more, because there were hundreds of Gospels, or at least 100 Gospels, you know, all by possessed by different sects who all believed they had the Orthodox Word of God. There were Gnostics. Yeah, so.
Can I ask you, what's the definition of a Gospel? Like, if I was to write down, you know, the Gospel according to Vinnie Eastwood or something, would that wash?
I think it would, in my opinion. A gospel is just it comes from the Greek term evangelion, and the good word or the good news. And basically, in my cynical opinion, it is what I call a God spell. That is, I don't believe it's from God. I don't believe it's the word of God. I don't even believe in God. I have no reason to believe in God. If God exists, she exists. I don't have evidence either way, so I'm not going to attempt to jump to a conclusion and form a belief about that. So I went off track. What was your thing?
I was just wondering, if I was to write a book called the Gospel According to Vinnie Eastwood, would that actually technically be a gospel? You know, what actually defines a gospel? What actually is it?
Like what makes a gospel canonical, like actually accepted as a legitimate Christian gospel?
Or any gospel. I mean, how many gospels are there? What are the parameters we're talking about?
Yeah, I don't know if you've heard of Acharya S. She's written a few books like The Christ Conspiracy, Christ in Egypt, and some very good books.
No, I've only heard of Acharya at a barbecue.
Okay. All right, well, look her stuff up. She's quite good. She brought out a book called The Gospel According to Acharya. And it's basically just some of her opinions on some of the different religious things and stuff like that. And so that was quite good. But yeah, I mean, you make a gospel according to Vincent, I'll read it.
Yeah. We did do a song called The Gospel According to Raptor Jesus. You ever seen the picture of Raptor Jesus?
I haven't seen a picture of Raptor Jesus, no.
Well, it's just a picture of Jesus with a raptor head, you know, like from Jurassic Park, and it says Raptor.
Oh, okay, but yeah.
It says Raptor Jesus. He went extinct for your sins.
And I just thought it was so funny, you know, and just, you know, with the clasped hands and everything looks so serene with a giant raptor head and stuff. It's just classic.
Actually, if you want some funny images, yeah, go to Facebook. Look at some of the atheist pages on Facebook, and even go to mine, because I put out a lot of, I make a lot of picture quotes and stuff like that that you can pick up. And I love some of the stuff that's floating around there. Most of my page on Facebook is original quotes that I make, and I'm collating them, and I think I might publish them, you know, like a gospel according to Sherlock. And that's a good name for a gospel, Sherlock. Yeah. You gave me an idea. You gave me a good idea.
There you go. The gospel according to the gospel according to Sherlock. Right. Well, we're going to be continuing this conversation off the air, ladies and gentlemen. So if you would like to be part of this conversation, if you have me on Skype, the Skype name is Vincent.Eastwood. If you want to listen in while we talk after the break with Suzanne Posel and Michael Sherlock, you can add me on there and we'll be continuing that in just a few moments. So, Michael, thank you very much for joining us on air. Suzanne Posel, the caller that we had, I think it was Ernest or something, and also our first hour guest named Ogmios, is a very talented musician. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen.